Pro sports is punishing as an industry. It's a punishing life. It's worldwide. It's nights, it's weekends, it's holidays. There's no option for balance. There's no way around it. That is just ingrained in the industry. And Hughes Norton, you know, goes through his eventual divorce. And then when he kind of wraps that page or two up, he says the top six executives that built IMG into what it is all lost their family lives. It was six for six. There's a lot of high achievers and great executives that have great family lives, but the sports industry is a bit unique. I'm Roberto.
And I'm Dan. On the Course Record Show, we talk about the business of golf.
We discuss the trends, insights, and strategies defining the industry now and into the future.
Welcome back to the Course Record Show, episode 35. We're presented by Holderness and Bourne. We're going to try something different this week. We are going to do CRS Book Club. Dan and I both read the recent Hughes Norton book called Rainmaker. The book is about Hughes's time at IMG from the early 70s through the late 90s, where he signed, represented, and was fired by Tiger Woods. It's a really, really good read. And we're going to just flip through some key takeaways. And then it was full of interesting nuggets. So Dan, first big takeaway.
Well, first big takeaway is that Hughes Norton went 25 years in the dark before coming out with the book. So lots of stories were bottled up to come out with this. And I thought it was really interesting to see some of this stuff. And it sounds
I want to stop there. I think that is a huge call out because the distance from the events, I think, lends them a lot of credibility. He has no axe to grind. He has no agenda. He has no ambition in the business. And other than one exception, which we'll get into later, I feel like he's pretty fair. He calls out his shortcomings, other people's shortcomings, his successes, other people's success. And he's pretty objective and, you know, very reflective and objective. Do you think?
I think so. And I thought it was particularly, I agree with all of that. And the timing of now what we're going on in pro golf with the fragmentation and the crazy money. I don't know that I would have jumped to pick up this book 5 years ago. But today, in today's day and age, this brings so much context into the psyche of the athlete and their management that the timeliness is very, very appropriate.
It is. You're right. And I would say 5% of the book is about the world tour, which ultimately becomes LIV. It may be 5%, but it's important. And it gives you a great background on what's going on right now. So, all right. Sorry to interrupt. Let's jump back into your first takeaway.
The book talks a lot about IMG, right? The International Management Group, which is Mark McCormick's firm and the company that Hughes Norton worked for. And they built this juggernaut, right? Like a crazy flywheel with a lot of different services embedded. And I kept thinking to myself, what's the grease that makes that flywheel run fast? I think it's jealousy. I think it really is. Like the notion of you sign these marquee players, you represent them successfully. The next crop sees that and wants a piece of that. And like the notion of being the top dog in the representation game, creating jealousy amongst peers, being the thing that attracts new and turning over clients. It's sort of a dark side of the human truth, but I think it plays a big role in the story here.
Yeah. You know, Scottie Scheffler said something after the Masters that the human heart always wants more. And that is part of the underlying motivation there. I could see that. And so my first takeaway was similar to yours. I think half the book is about IMG and about Mark McCormick. So you alluded to it about how fast they grew, how big they got. So let me read a quick excerpt to give some context to that. So Hughes goes and meets with IMG after business school. And he says, quote, IMG was a lot more than Arnold Palmer's agent. It was a sports marketing powerhouse. Cleveland may have been its birthplace, but within its first decade, the company had expanded to offices in New York, Los Angeles, London, Paris, Geneva, Tokyo, Cape Town, Sydney, and Christchurch. The original client base, a small stable of golfers, had exploded to include dozens of athletes with divisions devoted to tennis, skiing, racing, and team sports. They had IMG Literary Management, IMG Models, IMG Broadcasting, in addition to the MCI consulting arm. There was a division charged with creating and managing sporting events, another aimed at working with leagues and associations, and a huge and fast-growing division in Los Angeles producing television programming and films. And Mark McCormick was just getting started. A month after this, I joined IMG. So that's 10 years into what McCormick had done. That is incredible. And he was just getting started. So that's the scale you're talking about in your takeaway.
Yeah. And that led to a lot of different services, both the global reach and then, you know, representation and financial management and television and events, like you said. Not exactly sure how IMG went under the radar for antitrust for so long. Maybe it's just not that big a target for the regulators to go after. But there's a lot there.
Yeah. So at one point, they represented Gorbachev in a Pizza Hut commercial deal. And then at one point, Margaret Thatcher reached out and was like, I need IMG to represent me to help my image. So that's the kind of worldwide scale they had. In addition, I mean, part of my quote there, that MCI consulting arm, they basically invented the modern sports management industry, which means, you know, you're Coca-Cola and you realize, hey, I want to put my name next to world famous athletes on the PGA Tour or the Olympics or the NFL. And I need someone to help me figure it out. Because he says in the book that, you know, back then it was like lawyers and marketing people at these corporations that didn't know anything about sports. And he said, we can help you sort this stuff out. Don't get in a bad deal, get a good deal for your company. And that is a massive business now that includes, you know, WME, CAA, Octagon. There are a whole bunch of players in that space now. Sports marketing is a massive business. It's pretty wild. I mean, McCormick is almost the main, he is the main character in the book who started IMG. And I mean, Dan, you know, there's a lot of startups and entrepreneur content out there. And one thing I always think about is I can't remember who it is attributed to, but if you want to build a business, you need to figure out what the market is going to want before they figure it out and then offer it to them. And that's what McCormick did. And Hughes Norton, I mean, he says he's the most brilliant businessman I've ever come across. He was two steps ahead of everybody. He figured out, basically, this is my opinion, agree or disagree, corporations would want to align themselves to professional sports and pro athletes. That was the fundamental thing he saw, and that's what drove the explosion.
Yeah. No, it's funny. My next takeaway is very related to what you just said there, which is, and I'm stealing this from some entrepreneurship content that's out there. Have you ever heard the Founders podcast?
I think I have, yeah. I think that they. Really? I listened to the one about Bernard Arnault.
The one I'm going to reference.
Oh, really?
So great podcast. They kind of do what we do, which is like they take big biographies of leaders, business, sports, and politics, and they talk about like the guy goes through and really teases out some great highlights. And when he talked about Bernard Arnault, who, for our listeners who don't know, is the chairman and CEO of LVMH and, you know, the luxury conglomerate there. I think he's the richest guy in the world, if not top three. That if he could have two things tattooed on himself, this being Bernard, it'd be control and watch your costs. And Mark McCormick lived that to an extreme, right? He was really on top of his agents, what they were doing, how they were spending their time and their money, checking to make sure they were on the road. He was really petty about some really small little things, but that was the culture of IMG, and that's the culture that he embedded. He never seemed to want to step back and take it easy. He was on top of everybody all the time, and that was his maniacal drive to win and succeed.
Yeah, maniacal drive to win, succeed, and expand. Like Hughes calls him out as saying he never took a big number for himself, or he wasn't interested in the money. He was a top, it was all growth, all top line, expand my empire, expand my reach, expand my impact. It was not a bottom line driven business. And you're totally right. So some of the notes on that theme, he would check in with his direct reports every day at dawn, no matter what time zone he was in. He would call them when it was basically 5 a.m. where they lived. He would read all the correspondence flowing through his worldwide network of offices. He would periodically check the SkyMiles balance of all his top executives. Just nonstop control. And he's, over the entire business. And that leads to my second takeaway, which pro sports is punishing as an industry. It's a punishing life. It's worldwide. It's nights, it's weekends, it's holidays. And there's no shortcut. There's no option for balance. There's no way around it. That is just ingrained in the industry. And Hughes Norton, you know, goes through his eventual divorce. And then when he kind of wraps that page or two up, he says the top six executives that built IMG into what it is all lost their family lives. It was 6 for 6 on divorce. So that's not, yeah, there's a lot of high achievers and great executives that have great family lives, but the sports industry is a bit unique in that, in the punishing lifestyle.
Yeah, it sure seems like it. And I mean, you lived part of it too. So it's a tough way to make a living.
Yeah. Yeah. And the McCormick stuff is just incredible. He, you know, 4:30, wake up, start dictating letters and notes, meetings all day in 30-minute increments, show up on time, show up prepared, phone calls from the limo that would drive him wherever he was, whatever city he was in the world, dinner with a client every single night, and do it again the next day, 7 days a week. Just an absolute machine.
So good segue into my third takeaway, which is know what butters your bread. And this, what really stood out to me is the story of Laura Baugh, who's Eric Cole's mother, right? Rookie of the year last year. And so she came out in the pro scene, very attractive, very talented, but never won. We're never really delivered on that potential, but she did really, I mean, IMG was great at capturing her image and capitalizing on it all over the world. She struck great deals, made a ton of money with endorsements, but you know, that's a case of maybe where the cart got before the horse, and the golf performance, which fuels all of this, became a bit of an afterthought. So Tony Jacklin, I think, had a similar story in the book that was covered, you know, and in today's game, Ricky Fowler gets cited as someone who may be in that kind of boat. Whether that's fair or not, I don't know, but that comes up a lot. And it reminds me of a quote from Walt Disney, who, when he saw his company grow, to always try to remind his employees, guys, this all started because of a mouse, right? Let's remember this all started because of a mouse. So knowing kind of what your core really is, and sure, you can expand from it, but you can't get it twisted, and knowing what butters your bread really matters in business. And this story within the context of golf and sports made it very clear that it has to start and end on the course.
Yeah. And that, I mean, that's really what led to the Tiger situation, right? What led to him, Tiger firing him, and we can get to that, but all right. Counterpoint to that, IMG is a business expanded into all sorts of different things. Like they did Stars on Ice. They bought IMG Academy, Bollettieri down in Bradenton. They, you know, TV, they went all over the place. So, I mean, was it just McCormick being that much of a visionary? Because most businesses, like you're saying, when they expand past their superpower, really struggle. How did they make it work?
That's a good question. I don't know, but you see this happening a lot, right? I mean, think of the cycle we were in a couple of years ago where you heard are you familiar with the term ZIRP?
No.
Zero interest rate phenomenon.
Oh, right.
The fact that money was cheap, it just allowed for a lot of these expansions that were only justifiable during a very particular moment in time. And now in this operating reality are no longer. So I sense some of that might be going on, but I mean, all the services that McCormick put into IMG were all catered towards providing differentiation amongst the competition and catered towards the athlete's needs, right? So the great story about how when they signed Greg Norman, the first thing they did was get him out of like this crazy tax bill because his last agent didn't know how to deal with global taxes, for instance.
Yeah.
That's a unique differentiator.
Right.
And they charged 20% commissions when the rest of the industry did 10. So the take rate had to be justified somehow.
We'll cover some of that in kind of our shorter, you know, kind of nuggets, because I think we can expand on them. Some of them are really funny short ones, but I think we can dig deeper into the book by looking at those. But I'll go to my third takeaway, which, I mean, when you read a really good book, like those last 20, 30 pages, like time melts away, you know, like you're just like really get engrossed in it. And this was one of those books for me. It all comes to a head fairly quickly. He's fired by Tiger Woods. Shortly thereafter, he's fired by IMG. And he basically takes 25 years and then writes this book, and he processes that. And he's pretty brutal on himself and kind of his career. And so I'll read a couple quotes. One, when he got fired, he tried to rationalize it by saying, I was burned out. It actually was a good thing for me. Like, you know, I didn't need that anymore. Like, I'd already run my race. And then he goes on to say, quote, but that was all a rationalization, a comforting self-delusion. Further reflection led me to see the truth, which was just the opposite. Up until the day I received that fateful phone call from Tiger, I absolutely loved my job. I was on top of the world, repping the hottest athlete on the planet and reveling in my role as Rainmaker. My job had defined me, had made me who I was. I hadn't burned out. I was on fire, making millions of dollars for my clients, for IMG, and for myself. The money grab era of professional golf was roaring at full throttle, and I was front and center, fueling it, loving it, and fully energized. So that's, again, that's the credibility of the time that he's, if he would have written this 2 years after getting fired or 3 years, he would not have been through this process. And that honesty is pretty impactful.
Yeah. I mean, I think you mentioned this in past episodes, but success breeds success, right? It's really fun being really good at what you do.
Right.
Really fun. Until what isn't, or until you're no longer that good.
Right.
And that's a hard fall to take sometimes. And I mean, you hear it all over the time, right? People who went so hard and got caught in the proverbial rat race. And even if parts of the job really stink, right? It's just when you're good at it, it's a really hard thing to distance yourself from until something takes care of that for you.
Yeah. People love what they're good at. Bottom line. That's, even if it is not rewarding and it is messy in many ways, if you're good at it, you love it generally. So he goes on to say, in this kind of, it's all on the same page. He goes on in his retrospect and he says, quote, my workaholism had left me little time for introspection. I'd always thought of myself as humble, self-effacing, appreciative, the way I was raised. Intense to be sure, confident, but also terrified as coming across as arrogant or egotistical. But the evidence to the contrary was hard to deny. The horrific quotes in the Golf World profile, the realization that I had casual acquaintances, but few real friends, my inability to sustain a serious relationship, whether with prospective paramours or superstar clients. It certainly seemed as if Hughes Norton was somebody nobody wanted to be with long-term. Did I unknowingly project a demeanor the opposite of my own true values? Maybe what I needed during my IMG glory years was somebody to say to me what I made a point of saying to all those superstar clients when they became too cocky. Quote, you're full of shit. And that's where that part stops. And it's a really impactful finish to this book. And I don't know. That was my biggest takeaway is like, this guy put it out there. He looked at himself in the mirror and pretty impressive.
Success has a cost. It always does.
Any more on the, I mean, what are your thoughts on the Tiger stuff? So, I mean, we can dig a little bit there, right? He does say that it felt like maybe in the 1 to 5 years after he got fired and he tried to figure it out, he did figure it out. And it was two things. One, he had overworked Tiger. His job was to produce for IMG and Tiger just wanted to play golf. And two, O'Meara. He says that O'Meara fired Hughes and that the second that happened, he should have known that O'Meara was going to get Tiger to fire Hughes. What other thoughts did you have on that whole saga?
Well, and Norton was significant in trying to get O'Meara to be Tiger's mentor, as he was for those first years.
That was the irony in it. Yep. So he suggested Tiger move into Isleworth, where down the street from O'Meara. Yeah.
I know there was a moment there where there was a key piece where Norton, I think, opened up to Jaime Diaz for a golf world piece, and the piece came back very negatively. And I didn't think Tiger and Earl and that the Woods camp loved that.
Yeah. I think it was Rosefort, but yeah.
was it Rosa Portnikam? So that came back to bite, and you know, especially then, Tiger was pretty unrelenting, right? Like he fired Norton, and eventually fired Stevie, and that's a one way door, right? Tiger, yeah. you don't cross the guy and expect to get a second chance. Of course, Tiger's gone on to capitalize on some second chances himself, but certainly didn't extend those to others in this camp.
Yeah. So Tiger calls Hughes, fires him. Hughes says, no, let me meet you in person. I'm on the first flight down. He says, don't do it. My decision's made up. Hughes says, I'm flying down. Next morning, he shows up at the Isleworth clubhouse. He says, meet me at the front door. Meets him at the front door. They exchange two sentences, and that was the last word he ever spoke to Tiger Woods. And it just reminded me of the Tiger documentary where Stevie hasn't spoken a word to Tiger since the last tournament they worked together, which is fucking crazy.
Burr.
Yeah, burr. This episode is brought to you by Holderness & Bourne. Check out hbgolf.com for a spring refresh on the classics. There's something about a clean white polo under a sweater or a white polo for that first member guest of the season. Check out the white McDonald, a gray Ward sweater, and also some of H&B's bottoms. They're getting a lot of traction with their shorts and pants. They're a really comfortable performance fabric. The Parker and Garvey pants work great in the office, great on the golf course. Take a look at all the classics on hbgolf.com. That's the kind of gist of the book. Highly recommend it to everyone, but let's go through some kind of nuggets, because if you're a golf fan or a business, this book was like written for our podcast. It's just the perfect intersection of golf and business. So let's go through some quick hits, some things that, you know, you made notes of or you thought were just interesting nuggets in the book.
Let's pick up on the Tiger stuff. It wasn't always like that. So I don't know if you, so when Hughes Norton was negotiating a big deal with Nike, when Tiger just declared he was going pro.
Yeah.
Massive deal, you know, set all kinds of records. At the last minute, Hughes Norton almost got undercut. Not by another agent, but by Phil Knight.
Yeah.
So Phil Knight calls Earl Woods and goes, hey, let's forget these IMG guys. Let's just do the deal, you know, us directly. You don't have to pay Hughes or IMG their 20%. And at the time, Earl called Hughes right away and said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to stick with them. So there was, you know, before things parted and went south, there was quite a bit of loyalty there, which I thought that was an interesting nugget, because apparently Phil Knight despises agents, and I get why, but it does drive up the cost for him. But that's that was an interesting nugget that after watching Air in particular,
yeah,
was it last year it came out? I think last year, 2 years ago. I thought it was such a funny character of Phil Knight too.
Yeah. All right, so let's stay on this kind of era. Hughes signed Tiger to IMG by doing something really interesting. He went and met with him when he was 13 or 14, I think 13. And Earl said, hey, we're flying all over the country. Like, it's really expensive to do what we're doing and we can't afford it. Is there any way we can work this out? So what Norton decided to do, and he called the USGA and the NCAA to vet this, was hire Earl at IMG to be a talent scout. So that income would help Tiger fund his junior and amateur golf. And that's a pretty well-known story, but the funniest nugget for me was that Earl was like the worst scout in history. He would call Hughes about every guy that they played with, and he would say, Hughes, this kid can really play. And like, obviously 99% of them didn't turn out to do anything in golf, but I just thought that was hilarious. Like Earl Washington walking around watching junior golf and college golf and just thinking every kid is like, Hughes, this kid can really play. I thought that was hysterical.
Because who were Tiger's contemporaries in South SoCal? It was like Chris Riley, Bob May. It was
probably like Jason Gore.
Jason Gore. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, those guys obviously ended up having good careers, but there's a list of 50 other names that I'm sure were very good junior golfers, but didn't become, you know, professionals or even college players. Last one on Tiger. There's a short part around the firing that he says Tiger didn't care about the money. Tiger didn't care about the fame. Tiger just loved the game. And it was so evident at the Masters. Like the way he went around that Thursday and Friday and how tough and just,
I mean, this year's
Masters. 2024 Masters, the way he got that ball around in high winds, and you know, cut was six over, five over, and he finished at one over. That's a guy who is just driven by pure love of the game and just crushing people's soul and winning. And the fact that Hughes didn't see that early on, he gives Tiger credit for it, but he didn't see that and just say, I'm here to enable what this guy wants to do. It's understandable. He's the agent. He's the business guy. His job is to create income. But it was cool to hear him call out just Tiger's like pure love for the craft, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That was impressive stuff for sure.
All right. Let's stay on legends and kind of similar theme. Nicklaus versus Palmer. One thing I really thought about there was, so, you know, Hughes says I'm paraphrasing, but when athletes reach the top, they get an inevitable sense of empowerment and entitlement, and they all think they can do it themselves. So he kind of lost Norman that way. Nicklaus left IMG for that reason. Earl stayed with IMG when Phil Knight called, right? And actually Tiger's had representation his whole career. But looking back, Arnold Palmer stayed with IMG his entire life and had very little business stress, made hundreds of millions of dollars, like basically built a true business empire. Nicklaus had a couple near bankruptcies, has been, you know, in litigation multiple times, including recently where his brand is owned by 8 a.m. Golf or whatever. I thought about that a few times since reading the book, like, hire people to do what they're supposed to do. Like, you're not an expert at everything, right? And that juxtaposition of Nicklaus going off on his own in the business and Palmer just having IMG handle his affairs, I think there's a big lesson to be learned there.
Yeah, I mean, the whole player can do better on their own is interesting, because look at these examples of how Norton came in and delivered value early for his clients. So Tiger, we talked about, right? The massive deals with Nike and Titleist.
Right.
The Nike deal was completely guaranteed, there were some kickers to make it even higher, but like the $40 million for 5 years that he got,
right,
was completely guaranteed, which for someone who hadn't even pegged it up and in this previous tour starts as an amateur hadn't really impressed, right? Like, that's pretty, I don't think you get that negotiating one-on-one.
Right. And that's a nugget I didn't know. He had played like 15 tournaments as an amateur, you know, obviously the Masters and whatnot, and he hadn't really done anything. So it's a good call out. Yeah.
And Palmer had this deal with Wilson at the time that he had to show Wilson clubs and every other commercial he did, even if it was for a different company, worldwide rights. And then they completely changed that deal to give only rights in the US and reduce some of the restrictions. So Palmer could then do a ton more publicity in countries like Japan and elsewhere and make a ton more income. Like right off the bat, Hughes was able to sort of turn that around for Palmer and open that income stream up. I talked about Norman already with the tax situation, IMG, right? Being able to sort of get him out of a big tax bill because of his global play. So, I mean, players don't know this stuff. Right. I don't know this stuff, right? Like, I mean, this is like truly stuff you get from specialization, that great way to get value early, lock in the client. Sure, some of these guys walked away later, but the idea of like prove your worth early and create a big win was pretty felt with these stories and others.
Yeah. And it reminded me, so I saw a headline the other day, and this is not something I'm an expert in at all, but so private wealth, the number of family offices have tripled in the last like 5 years. And I know some of these are like propped up by big, you know, banks and investment firms kind of as a subsidiary, but it sounds like a bunch of people have made a bunch of money and they think they can, you know, they're hiring financial professionals to run their family offices. And some of them group together where like a group will manage a handful of families, but there's gotta be some analogy there to like saying, no, Goldman's going to run my money or JP Morgan or whoever, as opposed to setting up a family office. I kind of pulled some parallels out of that, but I'd love to learn more. Or if any listeners are in that world, like, are there parallels, or are we just spitballing here? All right, let's stay on the superstar themes. So I alluded to it earlier. The only person in the entire book that he does not hold back on is the shark.
He does not hold back.
He does not hold back on the shark. He literally puts the definition of narcissistic personality disorder in the book. And he goes on to attack him, the narrative of him being a business mogul. I mean, almost direct quote, what is his legacy as a businessman? Peddling beef, wine from another vintner, designing courses that need to be redesigned, getting fired by Fox for not preparing for the job. And then later he says his worst humiliation of his entire life was in the Liv hearings when it was revealed that he'd have to step down from Liv if the tour and the Liv made a deal. So it's the only person he goes after, like legitimately gloves off.
I think it gets worse than that. Here are the things I picked up on. No client in my experience ever loved making money more than Greg. Money validated him. Norman saw himself as a brilliant businessman, but there's little evidence to back that up.
Yeah.
And then the third, the story that most cringeworthy is Norman, already married, wanted to have an affair with some model that lived in Hong Kong. He couldn't use his own phone to call her because, yeah, you know, that'd be traceable. So he convinced Norton to let him use his phone, made a ton of calls, racked up thousands of dollars, which Norton really regretted allowing him to use his phone and being complicit in that.
Yeah.
And then to make things matters worse, Norman sips him with the bill and never pays him for the phone. Yeah. So it just.
And it was personal. It was personal. Norman and his first wife and Hughes and his wife and their children were all about the same age. They spent time together, like down in Florida. They were, you know, personally friendly. And when it kind of fell apart on the personal and business front, I think that was the only part that you could tell he had taken really personally, and no amount of time was going to heal that, that relationship. That was pretty harsh.
Yeah. That tough stuff there.
All right. Something a little more lighthearted. So my favorite podcast in history is the No Laying Up Steve Elkington interview. It's episode 204. And at about 46 minutes in, Elkington starts telling stories about Colin Montgomery. And I've listened to it probably a dozen times, and I cry laughing every single time. And part of this story is that Monty was not going to turn pro after college. He was just going to go work for IMG. So Elkington tells that story. And then in the book, it tracks completely. Hughes Norton is like, Colin Montgomery, who we ended up representing, was going to come work for us as like an intern after college because he didn't think he was any good. So anyway, those two stories, like perfectly tracking, I just got an absolute kick out of that.
Yeah, what's the thing? You're not going to work for us. We're going to work for you or something, because he shot and blitzed Muirfield or something for nine, shot 29 for nine holes or something ridiculous like that.
Yeah, he went and played golf as like his last interview and he made like eight birdies in the first nine holes. Yeah. So anyway, check out that episode of No Laying Up, episode 204, started 46 minutes if you want to get right down to it. It's got the funniest golf story I've ever heard in my life.
I've got a few more on McCormick here. We already talked about how aggressively expanded his company and how maniacal he was in his management style. There's a couple of things here that really, really stood out. So when Hughes Norton was considering which job to take, he was between a broadcasting job and a job at IMG. And the broadcasting job was going to be working for the CEO, Tom Murphy, who Bob Iger went to say, here's a quote from the book. Tom Murphy was unrivaled in our industry, not just for business, impeccable ethics, unwavering kindness, and boundless generosity. McCormick would never be described this way. just kind of paints a very,
yeah,
very backhanded picture that was not the guy he was about to go work for. And he obviously chose to do so anyway.
Yeah. I had that one written down. That's a huge one. I mean, so that Tom Murphy ended up going on to acquire ABC, which was then bought by Disney for $19 billion. It was the second largest acquisition in U.S. history. And Hughes had a job in as like Tom Murphy's personal, like, you know, assistant. And yeah, I mean, the opportunity cost is massive. I mean, who knows, right? 6 months later, he may get canned there, but it's considering how high of achiever Hughes was, I think he could have done some massive things down that path. So he said no regrets, but I thought about it a few times.
And then McCormick's out to dinner with Arnold Palmer. I think McCormick mouths out at the waiter or something like that. And Arnold Palmer goes, if you ever treat people like that again, we're done.
Yeah.
Which is so Arnold Palmer, right? Like you hear about everything about look people in the eye and give them a firm handshake and all that kind of stuff. I mean, just really, really checks out here too.
Palmer, Hughes doesn't sound like he spends a lot of time personally with Palmer, but Palmer comes out looking like Cherry in this book. I mean, you couldn't really, really impressive, like over 50 years, just doing the right thing, having other people in mind. I mean, there's a quote, I didn't write it down, but when Norman floated the world tour in the early 90s, he like got a big meeting. All the players showed up and Palmer walked in and said, like, the quote was something like, "Greg, we're not doing this because it's bad for the tour and it's bad for the fellas." That's end quote. And walked out the room and that was the end of it. And like totally blindsided Norman. But like, that was Palmer's take. It wasn't like, what could I get? What? It's bad for the fellas. And I was one of the great lines from the book. Palmer comes out. There's a lot of good stuff like that about him. All right. Talking about tour business, Dean Beaman was legendary commissioner of the PGA Tour. And I bought a book about him that's referenced in this book. He was an insurance broker till he was 29. Then he went on to win four times on the PGA Tour. And then at 35 or 36, they were like, well, we need a new commissioner and Dean's a damn smart guy. Let's just make Dean the commissioner. Unbelievable career. I had no idea that was his backstory.
Golf's an easy game.
Golf's an easy game. Yeah.
Yeah, that is wild. I mean, who else started really late? Like Larry Nelson was famous for starting late and having a great career, but that's...
Norman famously didn't like learn golf till he was like 17, but just... Beaman won the U.S. Amateur, I'm pretty sure. So he was a really good player, but just casually winning four tour events and then being like, let's make Dean the commissioner. He's a good dude. He's smart. Unbelievable.
Well, the other one that comes out, and I should have known this before reading the book, but there's a guy who comes out as legendary here is Fred Ridley, right?
Yes.
Chairman of Augusta National.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I knew him as chairman of Augusta National, but I didn't realize he won an NCAA title with Florida, won the USAM, goes on to, well, work for a very brief stint at IMG, and we can talk about why that didn't work. But I mean, the guy's an absolute stud in the world of golf. I don't think I quite realize how accomplished he was.
Yeah. So last player to win the amateur and not turn pro. And apparently he wasn't like that great of a college player. He was kind of the, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 guy at Florida and had a great week at Country Club of Virginia in Richmond, I believe is where he won the amateur and never turned pro. So Hughes said, the lesson I learned in hiring Fred Ridley was never start a guy from Florida in the Cleveland winter. So like he brought him up in November or something and his first 4 months at IMG was the middle of the Cleveland winter and it didn't last long. So, I had no idea he worked for IMG.
Is Cleveland to IMG what Omaha is to Berkshire Hathaway?
I guess. But the difference is, he said when he started at IMG, Hughes did, he went to Cleveland. And Mark McCormick didn't show up in the office for the first month that he was there. It was a worldwide business, right? So all those guys were probably living on airplanes and the support staff was in Cleveland. That's the difference. I think Munger and Buffett like just went to the office in Omaha for 80 years and just that's all they did.
Yeah, good old Cleveland. Doesn't an acquired taste, I think, as it comes out in the book.
Yeah. All right, other little funny story, Seve's visor from the 86 Masters. So I've watched that video 500 times as a kid in my grandparents' house. We watched it every day. So the double stack Nike visor, it was a one-time thing. Nike was either thinking about or trying to get into apparel and golf, and they signed like a one-week contract. And Hughes was like, I'm not even sure if they were just like, we need to stick something on a visor, or if it was like a Nike, like zany marketing, like it was actually like intentional. So I just thought that I didn't get any clarity. I still don't know. And it remains one of golf's great mysteries for those that are really into this shit.
Oh, Seve, I think, was responsible for Hughes Norton's nickname.
Yeah.
I think for a while there, his nickname was Huge.
Yep.
And because with Seve's Spanish accent, when he's trying to say Hughes, I think he came out as Huge. And a great nickname for an agent. I mean, Huge is what you want to be known as.
Right. And it got twisted into being like it was about his ego. He tried to clarify that wasn't the origin story of the name, but that's what it became. All right, my last nugget is so many of these biographies of people in their, I think Hughes is 75 years old, Ken Langone's, like all these kind of, they all go to these Ivy League schools and just completely blow it off. So his story is when he was like 14, his mom was like, you're going to get a good education. So I'm going to send you to Exeter. So she just like signed him up for Exeter. And then he was like, I was a good student. So I went to Yale. And then I signed up. I had no work experience, which was like the number one thing at Harvard Business School. But, you know, I applied and they let me in anyway. So all of these biographies are always like, well, I was never much of a student, but I, you know, I was a decent pitcher. So I went to Harvard. And it's just so crazy compared to the world we live in now, right? So, and they're all the same.
Yeah, the different process than what I used to get into business school, for sure.
Right.
But I mean, McCormick wrote a book, What They Don't Teach You at Harvard Business School, right?
Yes.
It's a pretty thick book.
Yeah.
So yeah, they're very blasé about that all that stuff.
It's always so casual. Like, well, I wasn't much for the books, but I did go to Columbia. All right. What, any other quick nuggets?
My last one is, you know, you bought and read the book in physical form. I took advice from one of our past guests, Jeff Shackelford, who said, we asked him, buy or sell audiobooks. I thought he'd say sell. He said, buy, especially if it's read by the author. And this one is. He's one who read this one. So I listened to it. I mean, I listened to a bunch of podcasts, so popping this in was not that different. And I really enjoyed it, consuming it that way. I hadn't listened to an audiobook in forever. So just a quick shout out to Jeff for the suggestion and Hughes for investing in the voiceover.
Yeah, you know, you told me you were listening to it, and I kept thinking while I was reading it, this has got to be the perfect book to listen to. It's just storytelling. It's got to be awesome. It's got to be an awesome listen. So, yeah, check it out on Audible or whatever. But really enjoyed it. Really glad he wrote it. I loved every bit of it. So thanks again to our sponsor, Holderness & Bourne. We will be back on the Course Record Show. Thanks all for listening. Send it to a friend. Follow us on Instagram, TikTok, and thanks again.
See you next time.